Hi there, welcome to this exam prep session for exam number 70-480, which is HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript. I'm Christopher Harrison. I'm a senior content producer here with Microsoft Virtual Academy and Microsoft Learning. So what we're going to do over the next hour, give or take 10 minutes, just depending on how long it takes to get through the material, is we're going to take a look at the certification process in general, and then start to dig into some of the different topics that are going to be covered on the exam. Now, one very big thing that I want to mention right away before we get started is the fact that this little session is not designed to get you from not knowing anything about HTML5, JavaScript, and CSS to being able to pass the exam, but rather to give you a sense of what to expect when you go in to take the exam, and to hopefully help identify some of the different topic areas that you may need to study up on. Now, as far as the exam itself goes, what you're going to notice is that the 480 exam is the entry point into three separate certifications: developing Windows Store apps, developing web applications, and developing SharePoint applications. So it's the entry point to all three of those. So like I mentioned before, we are going to talk about the basics of the exam, some of the different topics that are on there. We are going to have some sample questions and answers. The big thing that I want to stress, though, about those example questions is the fact that those were created by yours truly, so they're not actually exam questions. They're representative of what you're going to see, but these are not actual exam questions. Let's talk a little bit about the different topics that are covered by the exam. Now, the best thing to do when it comes time to study up for an exam is to figure out, well, what's actually going to be on it. And so what you're going to notice is that there's really four main topic areas: using CSS, implementing, manipulating the DOM, accessing secure data, and implementing program flow by utilizing JavaScript. Those are going to be the four main areas that are covered on the exam, and we're going to dig into a handful of those. We'll talk a little bit about drawing style and animations. We'll talk a little bit about some of the common HTML5 objects. We'll discuss how we can communicate from the client up to the server, and then also investigate a little bit of JavaScript, and in particular, we'll talk a little bit about jQuery. First up, drawing style and animation. Now, when it comes to drawing on the screen, there's a handful of different things that you could do. Yeah, you can always serve up images, but one thing that you want to consider doing whenever you're creating web pages is take advantage of SVG, which stands for Scalar Vector Graphics. Now, the whole concept of a vector graphic is that rather than indicating I want this pixel to be red and this pixel to be green and this one to be blue and this one to be blue and this one to be white, instead of doing that, what a vector graphic is going to do is say, all right, well, between this point, we want a line, and we want that line to be red. And right over here, I want a rectangle, and I want that rectangle to be blue. And the reason that scalar vector graphics are favorable when you're dealing with a web application is it can be less information to send down, because what you're doing is you're sending down instructions on what the screen is supposed to draw or what the browser is supposed to draw, rather than sending down that image, which again is just going to be all of those individual pixels. In addition, because of the fact that it is a set of instructions, it's also going to scale as well. So if the user's screen gets big, if the user's screen gets small, the image is not going to lose any fidelity, because all that's going to happen when it's resized is that the browser's going to look back at the instructions and now redraw that image just on a bigger canvas or on a smaller canvas. And you'll notice that you give the instructions down to the browser by utilizing a whole set of path commands. So you'll notice that you can say M to move the location so it won't actually draw anything. You can draw a line, you can draw an arc, you can draw different Bezier curves, and you can also just tell it to close the path, which will tell it to go back to the very beginning. Now, the thing about those vector graphics is that they actually become normal HTML objects and thus they can be transformed or modified just like normal HTML objects. Now, when you're looking to do transformations, you can do this in one of four ways. You can either translate, which is going to tell an object to go to somewhere else. So if this is the initial point, I'm now going to tell it, hey, I really want you over there. I can tell the object to rotate, which is pretty straightforward, so it would just maybe be like that. I can scale it, which is going to make it maybe bigger or smaller. And I can also skew it, which is going to, and I'm going to kind of terribly draw a rhombus over here, kind of slant things off to the side if you so desire. So those are the four different transformations that are available to you. You're also going to notice that we have transitions. And transformations and transitions sound very similar, but they are very different. So that a transformation is going to take an object and modify the way that it looks. What a transition is going to do, however, is dictate how we're going to move from one state to another state. And so what you'll notice here is I can set up a transition by identifying the property that we want to keep an eye on, how long we want the transition to actually take place, and then how it is that we want to move from that one property value to the other property value. I think the best way to see how all of this works is by getting in and doing a real quick demo. And I'm going to use Visual Studio Code for this. And let me just go in and create a real quick HTML document. And let me just say head, and I'm going to say style. And I'll put the style right inside of there. And let me close out style. And let's just format everything correctly. And you know, let's add in a title, demo, and close out my title. And let's go ahead and close out the head. And let's open up a real quick body. And let's go in and just say div ID equals target. I always just like that target name whenever I'm looking for something. And we'll say hello world. There we go. And close out the div, and close out the body, and close out the HTML. Okay, so inside the style, the first thing that I'm gonna do, just real quick for the demo, is I'm gonna say font size, and let's say 24 pixels, just to make that nice and big. So now what I wanna do is I wanna take a look at how we can use those transitions to create a neat little effect. And I'm gonna do that by starting off by saying target. And I'm gonna say color, and let's say blue. So we'll just start it off with blue. And then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna say target, and I'm gonna say hover. There we go. And let's go in and say color, and we'll say red. Red, there we go. No offense to Rebecca there. I'm sure the purple color that you selected is just fine. All right, so there is my little index file. So let me navigate on over to my desktop, demos, index, and we'll just open that up in Edge. And you'll notice that, sure enough, I've got Hello World. I need a bigger font size on that. And you'll notice that when I put my mouse over on it, that it is going to be red. Let's actually make that a little bit bigger, hopefully make that a little bit easier to see here. Let's say 36, and come back over here, and why are you? Oh, it would help if I didn't use class. Okay, there we go. So there we go. One little typo there, dot of course is class. And now you'll notice that when I put my mouse over it, it goes from blue to red. I would like to have that slide in a little bit. And the way that I'm gonna do that is just by simply saying transition, and we'll say property. And then we'll just simply identify that the property that we want it to keep an eye on is color. And then we'll say transition, and we'll say duration. And let's go ahead and say this should take 2 seconds. There we go. And so now let me save this and come back over here. We'll hit refresh. And now what you're going to notice when I mouse over that is it slowly eases into red. And when I pull the mouse away, it slowly goes back to blue. And all that I had to do to get that was just to simply identify the transition properties here. So you'll notice that I didn't add anything into hover. All that I simply said was, hover, I want you to be red. I said, when it's not hovered, I want you to be blue. And then I added in that transition section there to handle those transitions. So I could do that without having to do any programming whatsoever. All of that is 100% CSS. Pretty slick. Now, what you're also going to notice is that if I do want to get in and start drawing things out by utilizing JavaScript, that I have a canvas object available to me. And I'll let you take a look at the code there. The big thing that I want to mention, though, about using the canvas is that unlike SVG objects, which do become part of the DOM, the information that's inside of the canvas is not part of the DOM. So do keep that in mind, that while, yes, I can go in and draw everything by using JavaScript, the objects that are created inside of there do not become part of the DOM. Let's take a look at a sample question here. So what you're going to notice is that we've got a little bit of HTML, and then it says, hey, we need to ensure that all A elements, anchor elements, that are inside of the nav do not have an underline. And if we take a look at the document, what you're going to notice is that we've got our nav, we've got one anchor that's buried inside of an unordered list, and we've got another anchor that's inside of a div element. So the question is, which CSS selector should we use? And like we've already seen, don't use dot body. That's, of course, going to be class. There we go. Don't you do that. But you'll notice that it gives us the little samples over here. And what you're going to notice is that we've got nav, and then the little greater A, we've got nav space A, and then we've got nav div A. And so if we work through all of those different items and what they all mean, nav, of course, is going to look for everything inside of the nav, but that doesn't actually meet the requirement because we're just looking to target A element. So we can go ahead and get rid of that. Then what you're going to notice is that we've got nav and then that little greater than A. And what that means is that it's only going to apply to anchor elements that are direct children of, in this case, the nav, which is not the case. Both of these are buried inside of other containers. You'll also notice down at the very bottom there that we've got nav div A. So that would only apply to anchors inside of a div, inside of a nav. That's not going to meet the requirement. Then we've got this one here with the space between them. What the space is going to mean is we're going to look for any A elements anywhere inside of a nav. So it could be a direct child, or it could be buried underneath as well. So in this case, the correct answer is C. Hopefully you got that correct. Then what you're also going to notice is you have a custom font that's required for your site. The TTF file has been added. You need to ensure that all clients are able to use this font. What should you add? And what you're going to notice here is that this is a choose all that apply. So it's going to be multiple. And you'll also notice that each answer is part of the solution. And you'll always get that little indicator that it's either part of the solution or it's a complete solution. So we're going to need two different items here. So the first thing that we're going to need is we're going to need to identify the proper code to send down that little TrueType font. And you'll notice right here that there is the little call to that. So we now know that we're going to need either A or D, D as in Delta, to send down the font. And then what you're going to notice right here is the call to actually use that font. Now, if you're going to send down a custom font, you need to identify what you want that font to now be called and where it is. And then when you go to use it, you're going to identify that name, so that's going to match up. And then you could also add in a fallback. So the correct answer here is going to be A and B. Last but not least, you have a web application. You need to ensure that all text boxes that are required have a yellow background. What should you add to the style sheet? And you're going to notice here that we've got a valid and an invalid. Well, we can eliminate those right away because it's required. And then what you're going to notice with B and C, that we've got a colon there and we've got a pound sign. Remember, of course, that the pound sign is going to indicate ID. The colon is going to indicate what's known as a pseudo class, meaning that it's going to be a dynamic class based on the current state. So if the item is required, it's going to use that colon required. So the correct answer here is going to be B. And you can notice that it's a little dark there, but the correct answer there is B. Cool. So now let's talk a little bit about some HTML5 objects. HTML5 gives you the ability to send down media. Now, what you're going to notice here on this little slide is that I've listed off all of the various properties here. So you'll notice that we can have controls, auto buffer, auto play, we can tell it to loop, and we can also mute it. So I've added in all of the properties, but here's the real key, is we can specify fallback so that the first item that we list is going to be the first item type that it's going to try to play, the second, the third, and so forth on down the line. So that way you could try to send down an MP4. If that doesn't work, you could actually fail all the way back to a flash file if you need it. One other cool little HTML5 feature is what's known as the application cache, where I can tell the browser, hey, look, I want you to hang on to these files here. So for example, CSS and maybe an image. So that way, if we're disconnected, you can still use those files because they're going to be inside the cache. We can also indicate, hey, look, these are locations in which you must always be connected. And then finally, last but not least, we can even indicate scenarios in which maybe if we can't access a particular location, that we're going to fall back to a cached file. Now, one little problem with the application cache, and I do like it, is that unfortunately the browser can get a little bit too aggressive in trying to cache those items. Fortunately, you can go in and specifically tell the browser, hey, look, I want you to go update the cache and then replace that file. And the way that we do that is by calling application cache update. Now, keep in mind that that is an asynchronous operation. So what we're going to need to do is wait until it's actually recognized, oh yes, I've got new data and I've downloaded it, and then we could go ahead and swap that out. So that's the code to force the browser to update that application cache. HTML5 also gives us a geolocation object, and we could use this to go in and get a user's current position or keep an eye on where they are. And what you'll notice is that we can then get back their location, latitude and longitude, as well as how accurate the device thinks that that is. We could also potentially find out their altitude. And if we are looking for that watch position, we can also figure out their heading and their speed. You'll also notice down below that we can specify whether or not we want high accuracy. We can specify if we want a maximum age, which is basically how old is that data okay. And then finally, last but not least, is a timeout, which is going to indicate how long we're going to try to get that geolocation information. One very big thing to keep in mind about geolocation is that it's always up to the user to indicate whether or not they actually want to give you that information. All right, let's take a look at a couple more questions here. So you have an e-commerce application. You need to store information about the product the user is currently viewing in the browser, and you need to ensure that this information is not shared across tabs inside the browser. What should you use? And you'll notice that we've got local storage, we've got session storage, we've got cookies, and we've got the ASP.NET session object. Now, the ASP.NET session object doesn't have anything to do with HTML5, so we can get rid of that. Cookies are, of course, going to be those little bits of text that are either stored in memory or written out to disk, depending on the type, but those are going to be saved across all tabs or accessible across all tabs, so C is not going to be the right answer. And that leaves us with local storage and session storage, which are both HTML5 objects. Now, what local storage is going to do is that's going to write it out to disk. It's going to be available across multiple visits to the site, and there's only one local storage object per site. So as a result, it would be shared across tabs. The requirement is that we don't share it across tabs. And that's where session storage, or B, comes into play. That with session storage, it's going to be particular to that tab. And when you close that tab, it's then going to get rid of that data. And just to reiterate here, it's only going to be for just that tab. So the correct answer is going to be B, session storage. You have a page that displays a new article, a news article. Snippet of the page is displayed below. You need to display the article using three columns if the browser window is wider than 1024 pixels. Otherwise, one column should be used. What should you do? Choose all that apply. Each answer represents part of the solution. Now, what you're going to notice is that, again, we've got the choose all that apply, and again, each is going to represent part of the solution. Now, one big thing to keep in mind whenever you're going through these types of questions is that it's going to give you a scenario that works. Now, keep in mind that it might not always be the one that you would go with. That when it comes to doing media queries, there's oftentimes multiple ways that you could achieve the exact same result. So what you want to do on a question like this is read what they've given you, analyze it, figure out what it would do, and then go ahead and choose the right answer. So if we take a look here, what we're going to notice, first of all, is we can break this down into two halves again. So we've got the media query up at the top, and then we've got the article section down below. And if we take a look at the media queries, what you're going to notice is that we've got, and I'm just going to change this to the highlighter here, max width, and we've got max device width. Now, the difference between max width and max device width is that max width is going to indicate the width of the browser. Device width is going to indicate the width of the device. And so it's possible that the device might be, let's say, 1920, but the browser is only 800 pixels wide. And the requirement is that the browser window is what we're taking a look at here. So because of that fact, we can now eliminate B as a possible answer. And so we know that we've got to use A. Now, if we take a look at A, what you're going to notice is that it's going to indicate, hey, look, at that point, we're going to make the column count 1. So if it's up to 1024, the column count's now going to be 1. So we need to set the default of the column count to then be 3. So the correct answers are going to be A and D. Let's talk a little bit about remote communication. So how do we communicate from the client up to the server? Now, at a very low level, one way that we can do this is by utilizing the XML HTTP request object. Now, this object has been around basically forever, and it's very low level. And so what you'll notice is that we can open up the connection, just like you see there, indicate the HTTP verb that we want to use, indicate the location that we want to go to, and go ahead and indicate whether or not we want this to be an asynchronous call, which, by the way, is the default. And then what we can do is say, all right, look, when this changes, when the state changes, we want to go in and take a look. And the main state value that we're going to be looking for is 4, which indicates, hey, look, we've got data and everything was downloaded. And then what we can go in and do is go grab the response text. That's the information that came back. And then we could go ahead, and in this case, they're actually doing something a little bit fancy. We're actually going to be parsing that with JSON, actually get a JSON object back. We'll go ahead and put that into a product list, and then we'll call display list and have it display out. And then you're going to notice down at the very bottom, we'll actually send that up. So what I want to do is I just want to clear all of the ink, and I just want to walk through this real quickly here, that the basic steps are to new up the object, to call open, which is going to set everything up, to set up the event handler for when the state changes, and then finally go ahead and actually do the send. If we take a look at a little demo here, and I'm going to go into module 4, from another set of demos that I had done previously, and I open up my XHR, we can actually see a little bit of sample code right here. So just like before, what you're going to notice is that we're going to set up the object. We're going to set up the ready state change. I just have that below or above the open. That's just fine. And again, what we're going to be looking for is the ready state to be 400. And then the status code, we'll look for 200, which of course means success. We'll go ahead and grab the text. And then we're going to display that out by utilizing a little bit of jQuery. And then, like I said below, the open is just simply going to get everything set up. And then the send is going to actually send the request. So if you leave off send, it's not going to actually go up. Now, real quick side note here. One of the things that is common on exams is a question where they're going to give you a scenario and then ask you, how would you accomplish this? And quite frequently, they'll do that by giving you code blocks and then ask you to move the appropriate code blocks from one side to the other and then order them. And if you stop and think about it, that kind of makes sense. Because one of the goals of an exam is to figure out, hey, do you know how to do this? We're trying to test for that knowledge. And so a great way to do that is by asking you to put the appropriate code in the appropriate order. I'm not, and I mean this, I am not saying that I guarantee that this is going to be on the exam because I don't know what's going to be on the exam. And even if I did, I couldn't explicitly state it. Everybody who goes in and takes the exam signs a non-disclosure agreement. But that being said, one big thing to note about this is that in order for this code to actually work, you need to specify send. And if you don't, it's not going to work. So if you do see a question where it says, hey, we're going to use the XML HTTP request, make sure that you've got send at the very end there. Okay, so there is that. And if I take a look at demo text, what you're going to notice is that it's the basic hello world. I'm going to go ahead and run this page, little control F5, chugga, 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 and I'm going to click on that little load data button, and sure enough, it's going to specify hello world right there. Cool. Now, if you want to get a little bit fancier with your data requests, you could also go in and use AJAX. And the AJAX option is provided by jQuery. And you can actually get very low level like I've got right here, where we're going to indicate the URL that we want to go to, the verb, the data type that we're going to send up, the content type that we're expecting back, the data, and then what function to call on success, and then what function to call on failure. But we can also get a little bit easier. Oh, by the way, real quick, there's the reading JSON. So when we got the JSON back, we could actually loop through all the objects. The big thing to keep in mind about JSON data is that it's just going to be JavaScript objects. But I want to go back here, and I want to take a look at a simpler way to make an AJAX call, which is just by using the get function. And what get will do is it will make the call and then just get the JSON data back and pass that into an event handler that I've got right here. So in this particular case, it's going to display out that data. And in this case, it's actually just going to be the raw text. And we'll just go ahead and run this. Hit load data. And then that's just going to give us the basic text. And I want to go back and just kind of make sure that I'm clear on something. That the two little helper methods that we've got is the get. And this will get text data. And then we've got get JSON. And this would give us JSON data, if we wanted JSON data. So that's going to give us text, and that's going to give us JSON data. Okay, cool. HTML5 also includes this neat little option to use what are known as WebSockets. Now, WebSocket allows for two-way communication from the client to the server, and more importantly, from the server to the client. Now, I want to walk through the code snippet here, then I'll show a demo. And to start with, what you're going to notice is we're going to check to see, hey, do you support WebSockets? Just by doing a real quick if statement. And then we're going to new up the WebSocket, and what you're going to notice is the protocol here. And this is key. WebSockets do not use HTTP. They don't use HTTPS. They use WebSocket protocol. So you need to specify with that URL either WS for WebSocket unencrypted, or as I have in my slide here, WSS, which is going to be WebSocket secure. And then once the connection is open, we can go ahead and send a message. Now we'll send that up to the server. And then we can receive messages by using onMessage, which will get us data back. And we could take a look at the event type, see whether or not it's JSON data, see whether or not it's text data, and then go ahead and display that data out. And if we go back to Visual Studio here, and I open up my sockets, what you're going to notice is basically exactly what we had on the slide. So that I new up the WebSocket, specify, again, that protocol there. And then when we receive a message, we'll go ahead and display the data out. I'm not checking the data type. I know it's going to be text here. And then what you're going to notice is that for the on open, I'm just simply going to remove an attribute of disabled. So that way it will it'll be enabled at that point. And then you'll also notice that we'll go ahead and set up a send for when they click on a button to actually send data from a text box up. So that's going to send to the server. This is going to receive from the server. And then last but not least is that's going to let us know when the connection is available. And keep in mind that if you are going to send data, the connection must be available. So let's go ahead and launch the browser here. And what you're going to notice is I'm just going to type in a real quick message here. And the way that this is designed to work is that the message will be sent up to the server. The server is going to reply back. And then you'll notice after a brief delay, a second message will come down. And that brief delay and that second message is designed to simulate the server sending a response back, maybe because a value inside of a database was updated or something like that. So let's go ahead and hit send message here. And sure enough, there's my hello world processed. And then there is the other message send. And so that was the second one that then came down from the server. Now on the JavaScript front, you're gonna notice, of course, that we've got jQuery. And you can see the marketing slide on jQuery right here. The big thing that I wanna mention about jQuery is that it is covered in the exam. You are going to need to know about jQuery. Now, as a slightly shameless plug, I would mention that if you check out Microsoft Virtual Academy, we actually have a full course on jQuery that was put together by Rachel Appel, Jeremy Foster. Great way to get up to speed on jQuery. Now, another little JavaScript, an HTML5 component that you can take advantage of is a little thing known as a web worker. And what a web worker is designed to do is it's designed to simulate, if you will, threading. Now, the way that a web worker works is that you, first up, create a new worker and specify the script file that you want to load. That script file will then wind up on that separate thread. And that's my universal sign for a thread. It's about as good as my drawing gets. That's it. Now, the way that this works, the way that the worker system works, over here is my worker, over here is the original calling page, is it works on a basic messaging system. So that you send messages over by utilizing post message, and the worker sends messages back by utilizing actually that same exact function name, which is helpful, but the event on the other side is on message. So on message to receive, post message to send over. And it's the same regardless of which side that you're on. So from the page, I want to send a message to the worker, I use post message. On the worker, I want to send a message back to the page, post message. On the page, I'm receiving a message from the worker, on message. On the worker, I'm receiving a message from the page, on message. So you'll notice that perfect symmetry there. Now, one very big thing to keep in mind is that the web worker is going to start automatically. So the moment that you say, hey, I want to create this, whatever's inside that script file is immediately going to start running. So if we want to go in and stop that, prevent that from happening, you are going to want to delay execution of that by utilizing some very basic start-stop mechanism. Just send a little message over, send a message back. Now, I am going to kick over here to the worker slide, just so that way you can see how all of that works. And what you're going to notice right here is I've got the basic messaging set up. And so I'm going to look for that start, and if it's start, then we'll go in and change that started value. Otherwise, we'll go in and try to send a message back here, and that's only going to work if it was actually started. So you can kind of see that really easily there. Now, the big thing, again, that I want to highlight is you are going to notice I want to send a message on over, post message. I want to receive data. It's going to be on message. Once again, let's take a look at a real quick little demo. So I'm just going to come right up here. There's my basic little worker here. This is just going to work as an echoing system. So we're just going to receive the data off of eData. Now, do want to mention that that could actually be a full-blown object. In this demo, it's just a string, but it could be a full-blown object. We'll process that, and then to simply send that back by calling postMessage. And you'll notice that inside the worker, we use self to indicate, hey, this is the worker. On the flip side, you'll notice that we've got basic web worker, and that's just the name of my HTML file. But what I want to highlight here is, once again, I'm going to new up that worker. I'm going to specify, hey, when we receive a message, we'll go ahead and display it out on the page, and we'll send a message on over when a user clicks on that button. And again, we use post message for that. So if I run this, what you're going to notice is this will be my message one, and I'll click send message. Sure enough, that was processed. We'll say message two. Sure enough, that was processed. And then it's just turtles all the way down from there. So there's my basic little web worker. JavaScript does give you the ability to create objects, but they're just inside of functions. Now, this is one of those little tricky spots that you want to pay a little bit of attention to, that if you've been using JavaScript more of just a procedural and event-based system and not really working a lot with objects, you are going to want to make sure that you spend a little bit of time working with objects. And what you're going to notice here is that, again, the way that we create an object is by utilizing function. This actually has a constructor, and so we can store that internally. And then what you're going to notice is that we can set up a little function and then determine how we want to return that back out. And so you'll notice right there is that little call to getName. And of course, we're just generically using an alert there to display that out. Now, once again, if you are looking for a little bit more information, there is an MVA for that. The one that you're going to want to search for is JavaScript for experienced developers. Okay, one last question. So what you're going to notice is that they've given us a little scenario, and the couple of key parts here is you're going to notice that we make a call to text here utilizing an output selector, you see right there. And then what you're going to notice is that right there, there's a div element with an ID of output, and it tells us that no text is displayed. What should we do? And you'll notice that we've got the ability to update the little function call, and I'm going to highlight the two items there. You're going to notice that we could update line 5 to that, or we could update line 5 to do that. Now, let's talk things through here real quick. What load is going to do is actually go off to the server. We don't want to do that. What this would do is it would wind up trying to convert update page into a jQuery object, so we don't want to do that. So then the only ones that we're left with are A and C. And you want to make sure that you're spotting the difference there. And you'll notice on C that it's using a pound sign, and on A it's using a dot. The pound sign, of course, means ID. Dot means class, so the correct answer is going to be C. Cool. All right. Now, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about where to get a bit more information. Best place to go find information about this exam is to the exam page itself. The simplest thing to do is just head on over to Microsoft.com/learning, and you could either type in the full URL or just simply do a search for 70-480, and then you'll notice the skills measured, which will give you a lot more information on what's going to be covered on the exam and what to expect. Now, here at Microsoft Virtual Academy, we of course have you covered with all sorts of courses that are available. Got a couple listed right there for you, and got a couple more listed for you as well if you're looking to dig further into JavaScript. Now, if you prefer books, you're going to notice that there's a couple of books that are available for you as well, a training guide, as well as an exam reference that you can go ahead and check out. And if you're looking to get connected with either Microsoft Learning or with other learners, you're going to notice that we've got Born to Learn, and you'll notice that we've got study groups there that you can use to actually communicate with other students, other people that are going to be taking the exam. And there's also a prep wiki as well to help provide additional resources. Okay, so what we took a look at here was the basics of the 480, talked about some of the different topics that are on there, and hopefully gave you a few tips that you can use when going off to take the exam. So with that, I want to thank you for tuning in to this prep session, and I just want to say good luck.